Good morning, everybody. So, Alistair and Susan are on their annual sojourn in the islands, and so Alistair's requested I speak to you this morning, and I hope that together we're going to learn something about the will of God for us. Let's just pray for a moment. Father, we come before you humbly this morning, and we ask that you would quieten our hearts, open our minds, open our eyes. And we pray, Father, that this morning as we explore your words to us, you will touch us and change us. We want to be more like Jesus, Father, closer to you, nearer in likeness, nearer in presence. And we ask this morning you would be with us and help us in that quest. For this is our prayer. Amen. So my youngest daughter, our youngest daughter, Emily, has a dog. And if this works, this is she. I can finish my sermon right there, can't I? With that awe. And Molly and I were dog sitting, were just sitting one day, and on the way home from a walk, we stopped off at the supermarket, and whilst Maureen went inside and got some things, I sat outside on a bench. This bench, the very bench. Soon I was joined by two elderly ladies, and one said to the other, "How's your lumbago?" And the other said, "Oh, he's a lot better since I got my new medicines." And, "How's your husband's?" "Well, he's a lot better since he's had those tests." And that was the kind of conversation they had for a while. And eventually, a car drove up, and one lady said to the other, "Oh, here's your daughter now. Well, I'll see you next week. Bye-bye." And as the car drove out of sight, said, "Bye-bye, bye-bye," she turned to me. She said, "Do you know, I don't know who she is." And I said, "I'm rather surprised at that, given the nature of your conversation." She said, "Well," she said, "I come every week with my carer, and whilst my carer's inside doing the shopping, I sit outside having a smoke. And that lady comes with her daughter, and when she's finished, she comes and joins me on the bench, and we talk about all our ailments. But," she said, "I don't know her name, and she doesn't know mine." And I said, "How long has this been going on for?" And she said, "3 years." Now, I don't know who you are, but that's funny. Whoever you are, that's funny. Okay. And as you can imagine, I've told that story a few times. And I was reflecting on the story recently, and actually the spotlight turned on me. And I saw it in a new light. And I thought, is this really so different to the way that I so often behave? Do I have relationships where I've been content with a superficial following of a ritual and similar to my two ladies? What about you? What about on Sunday morning? What about this morning? Are there people here or at work who you talk to regularly? Maybe people even in your family, who, when you get right down to it, you really don't know them as you would like to admit? It seems to me that we establish, as my two ladies did, what we might call a ritual form of engagement, the things you talk about when you meet, and you never get beyond that. A form of connecting that's one-dimensional, that doesn't get below the surface, that's not real in its meaning. Is that okay? Is that just the way it is with relationships? Am I unduly concerned about it? Or should we be challenging ourselves to go further and to go deeper in our relationships? What would Jesus do? Jesus says to us, by this, we just read a similar verse in the letter of John, "By this, in John 13, all men will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. Paul encourages the Ephesian Christians, be imitators of God as beloved children and walk in love. Love is the defining, distinguishing characteristic of the disciple of Jesus. It reveals to us the nature of Jesus, the very nature of God. As we've just read, John the Apostle writes, God is love. Now, I want you to look that in each case, the Greek word translated love is the word agape. What kind of love is this agape? How are we to love? Who are we to love? Well, as we know, the New Testament was written in Koine Greek. It was related, but it was different to classical Greek. It was simplified Greek, the common tongue. Due to its simplicity and ease of translation, it was a brilliant language with which to unify the Greek Empire and then the Roman Empire of New Testament times. It's very similar to the role the Quran plays today in the Muslim world. A couple of years ago, Maureen and I were talking to a Muslim in Marrakesh about his faith. And he was saying that because of the language of the Quran, he could travel anywhere in the Muslim world and be understood. It was the same in the New Testament times with Koine Greek. Well, Koine Greek included four words that are generally translated love, but really talk about the nature and the quality of relationships. And I'm hoping you can see some of that on the screen. Eros, storge, philia, and agape. And the numbers here, the frequency of occurrence in the New Testament. Only the families of philia and agape occur in the New Testament. A compound word of storge occurs just once in Romans chapter 12, verse 10, when Paul talks about brotherly affection. And we'll look at that in a moment. But frequency of usage alone in the New Testament tells us there's something special about this word agape, and we should look closer at it. We'll look at these other words later. Although Koine Greek is considered by scholars to be relatively easy to translate, we always lose some meaning in translation. And on the screen is a quote from the great William Barclay, the New Testament scholar. He writes, "Translation from one language into another is in one sense impossible. It is always possible to translate words with accuracy when they refer to things. A chair is a chair in any language. But it's a different matter when it's a question of ideas. Furthermore, words have associations, and these associations give words a certain flavor which cannot be rendered in translation, but which affects their meaning and significance in the most important way." So, to help us to understand these associations, the flavor of the words, what people thought of when they used the words in New Testament times, and therefore what the New Testament writers would have thought, scholars go to four different sources. They go to classical Greek, the writings of Homer and Plato and Cicero and so forth, dating from about 800 to 200 BC, before New Testament times, in other words. They go to other Koine Greek texts, which include works of literature, historians, Manetho, Epictetus, and so forth. They go to the Septuagint, which was the Old Testament, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, and what's known as the papyri, thousands of documents, ordinary documents, tax returns, shopping lists, poetry, letters, private letters. Let's look at these sources very briefly and ask, well, what do they tell us about this word agape? Well, the first thing to notice is that there are relatively few occurrences of agape in classical Greek and in the Koine texts. The verb form, to love, to agape, is found a few times in classical Greek, but it's used to denote friendship between equals, sometimes sympathy. Sometimes it took on the meanings of to prefer something or to prioritize something, to esteem one person above another. For example, the Roman historian Dio Cassius records Antony speaking of Caesar saying you loved him, philia, as father, but you held him in regard, agape, as benefactor. Interestingly, we have a few instances, about four instances in the New Testament, of the use of agape in this way. For example, Paul writes of Demas, Demas has forsaken me, having loved agape, this present world. John writes, men loved agape, darkness rather than light. But what's beyond dispute is that in classical Greek, agape had nothing of the power or the passion of eros and the warmth of, or the warmth of phileo. One Greek scholar says about agape that its meaning was weak and subject to change. And this is important. And you might think unexpected, given the prominence of the word agape in the New Testament. So what's going on? For those who don't know, the Septuagint was the Koine Greek translation of the Old Testament. By the first century, the time the New Testament was written, the Septuagint was the Old Testament of the Greek-speaking Jews. And it became the Old Testament of the New Testament church. And so it is natural that the New Testament writers would quote from it. In fact, two scholars analyzed this and established that the Septuagint is quoted around about 340 times in the New Testament, whereas the Hebrew text, the scrolls from which Jesus would have read in the synagogue, the Hebrew text is quoted just 33 times. So the Septuagint, this Greek translation of the Old Testament, played a central role in the early church. It was the scriptures of the early church. What does it say about agape? It turns out that the verb agape is very common in the Septuagint. But it's used to translate as many as 19 different Hebrew words. It's used to describe Abraham's love for Isaac, Isaac's love for Rebekah. It describes God's love for Israel and the love Israel was expected to have for God. But it's also used twice as the opposite of hatred. It's used 14 times, especially in the Song of Solomon, to describe sexual love. Now, this is significant, not just because the sexual connotation is completely missing in the New Testament, but because agape played such a central role in the teaching of the apostles. It means we cannot trace the meaning of agape to New Testament Christians back to the Septuagint. What about the informal papyri, the language people used in day-to-day life? In fact, amongst the thousands of documents that have been translated to date, there is just one instance of agape, and that's where a writer ascribes the name agape to the god Isis. The only one. It's astonishing that agape, this definitive word coursing through the teachings and the writings of the New Testament church, is almost absent in the Greek of the time. It seems to have been an obscure, weak, little used word, and yet the New Testament writers adopted it. Why did they do that? Why was agape adopted as the central teaching about the nature of God and our relationship with God and one another if it was so little used? I think to understand that, we have to look at the other words. Now, we need to be careful not to overplay this. We only have time for a broad brushstroke description of these words. And like any living language, which it was at the time, people didn't always follow the rules. Nevertheless, the other words, eros, philia, and storge, had very clear, definitive meanings in Koine Greek. Eros was a word that had its basis in passion and sexual love. The Greeks delighted in physical beauty and desire, the sensual and spontaneous and the emotional aspects of human nature were elevated. For Plato, eros represented the striving for righteousness and wisdom. Aristotle took the concept further, suggesting that the striving for wisdom and righteousness through eros, through experience, eventually gave one the experience of ecstasy and therefore union with the transcendent, as he described it. So you see, when a man and a woman are sexually attracted to one another, that's eros. But eros isn't only about sexual love, and we've lost that in our common modern-day understanding. It was also used to describe the emotional response one feels to art, to music, to nature, to architecture. That's eros. Storge was a word to do with, in particular but not exclusively, family affection. It brought to mind a love based on relationship, affection, and sentiment. Storge is a response to the person who is being loved. Victoria and Emily are my daughters and I love them. That's storge. My brother Peter don't have an awful lot to do with one another. It's one of those relationships you kick it around rather than you water it and tend it. And we call each other every now and again. But you know, if my brother needed me, I'd be there for him. That's storge. Philos is sometimes explained as to look on someone with affectionate regard. The Greek scholar Kenneth Wurst says, "Philos is a love which consists of the glow of the heart, kindled by the perception of that in the object which affords us pleasure." The word is used to speak of friendly affection. So philos was rooted in the perceived pleasurableness of the person or thing that is being loved. Last week, Maureen and I went on a bit of a trip down south, and we caught up with some friends. We went out with some old school friends, and it was great to catch up. We hadn't seen them for a while, but it's amazing. There are some people who, when you catch up with them, you just pick up where you left off. And our conversation was real. We talked about career, family, health, all sorts of things. And it was fantastic to catch up with them again. Why do we have that friendship? Because back in school days, Maureen and I were at school together. Another ah moment. Maureen was made to sit next to me as a punishment. That's how we met. True. But back in school, Brian and Donna, something just clicked, and we liked each other. We enjoyed one another's company, and it's continued through the years. That's philia. So these words, eros, storge, and philia, had very strong associations with pleasurableness, with the idea of responding to the thing that is loved. Agape, on the other hand, had none of the warmth and tenderness of those words. The great W.E. Vine writes, "Agape is the characteristic word of Christianity, and since the Spirit of Revelation has used it to express, listen to this, ideas previously unknown, inquire into its use, whether in Greek literature or in the Septuagint, throws little light upon its distinctive meaning in the New Testament." Isn't that fantastic? What he's saying is that agape, as we need to know it, as you and I need to understand it, is a totally New Testament concept. And we seek its definition in the New Testament and nowhere else. Could this be why, for example, Paul saw fit to write a chapter on love in 1 Corinthians 13 to a Greek-speaking people to explain what agape means? So, do you need to understand Koine Greek to understand the agape of love? The good news is, no, you do not. So, what do we learn about the agape of God when we study the New Testament? Agape describes the essence of God. John writes, "God is love." In other words, it is in his nature to agape. God loving us is not dependent upon anything we do or we are. God is unchanging and he loves us. John 3:16, "For God loved," agape, "the world, that he gave his only Son, that whosoever believes on him should not perish, but have eternal life." Second, agape is a choice. C.S. Lewis writes, "Love in the Christian sense..." It's okay, is it? It'll come back. Love in the Christian sense does not mean an emotion. It is a state not of the feelings, but of the will. And that state of the will which we naturally have about ourselves and must have about other people. You choose to love. You don't fall into agape or fall out of it. Third, agape is the power by which we love the unlovable. Paul writes in Romans 5, God shows his love for us in that while we were sinners, Christ died for us. The great Emil Brunner, theologian, and I think this is simply beautiful the way he expresses this. He wrote, "If I love you because you are so-and-so, I love you with eros. But if I love you in spite of you being so-and-so, my love is agape." That is the character of agape. It is a love that does not seek to fill up my own soul, but to fill you, to replenish your emptiness and not my own. Agape, fourthly, builds relationships. Again, C.S. Lewis, consequently, though Christian love sounds a very cold thing to people whose heads are full of sentimentality, and that is quite distinct from affection, yet it leads to affection. It's no accident that Paul opens his central teaching, ethical teaching in the book of Romans, with the instruction, let love, agape, be genuine. Don't fake it. And he quickly moves on to say, love, that's Philadelphia, one another, with philostergos, brother affection. You've got everything apart from eros in there. In other words, our agape love is to be expressed to one another in the context of the same caring, tender, affectionate love as we see in human families. The theologian Niels Faraye summarized the meaning of agape. Agape is unconditional love. Agape is never dependent upon the response of the object for its motivation. And then quoting the great Swedish theologian Nygren, in Nygren's terms, agape is unconditional, uncaused, unmotivated, groundless, uncalculating, spontaneous love, creative of fellowship. So what does this mean for us? For you and me? The initiative is with me and you. That's what it means. It's for you and me to make the first move. You know, there are times when there's been a bust up between two people and they're not talking or they're falling out with one another, and maybe you've been trying to broker a deal. Maybe you've been one of those individuals. Do you recognize the phrase, well, I'm not going to call him until he calls me first? That's not agape. Or someone who holds back on the basis that it's always me who makes the first move. It's always me who telephones. It's always me who does whatever it is, dot, dot, dot. It's time for them to show some interest. That's not agape. Phileo drives us to spend time with people we already know or with who are appealing to us. We engage with our family and our friends because it makes us feel included, safe, happy, supported, complete, encouraged. You fill in the gap. But God's love, agape, drives us to reach out to people because we want them to feel safe, included, happy, supported, complete, encouraged. You fill in the gap. Take Sunday mornings. Do you gravitate to and stay with your family and friends? Or do you notice people who you don't know and reach out to them? It's not easy to reach out to people. It's easier to remain in the safe circle of people you know. But that's what agape is. It's a reaching out. Because it's not about you, it's about them. Watch this, do you think? It's my impression of an iceberg with a waterline. And I'm calling the waterline the line of visibility. What's above the, apply this metaphor to you and to me. What's above that line? It's the stuff that's visible to people. It's the stuff that we want people to see. It's the public self and what's below the waterline. It's the stuff we share only with the people who are closest with us. We share this kind of thing only when it's safe to do so. And we're all icebergs. Your words might be a little different to the next person's. And you know the really odd thing is that most of us assume that everybody else is sorted. People at work are icebergs. A couple of years ago, I was talking to my boss, who is a director of Lloyd's Banking Group, a double first from Oxford, an accomplished musician, fantastic family, two teen boys, successful, highly regarded, and a great boss. I recall one time, this is when just a meeting between him and me, and we were chatting, and he'd just taken on a new responsibility to lead a multi-million pound, highly visible, very important program for the bank. And I don't remember why, but I just felt he needed me to say that, you know what, a lot of the time, inside, I'm not really as confident as I might appear to be. You know, I just do my best. And I was saying to him, you know, sometimes I look at the decisions I have to make and I think, how on earth did I get myself into this situation? One day, somebody's going to figure it out and boot me out. And you know, he said to me, he said, that's me. He said, I'm just the same. And from that moment, our relationship and that conversation went to a new level. You know, we talked about, subsequent to that, about family, about career, about religion, about politics. And I achieved with him a relationship I don't think I've ever achieved, a quality relationship with any other person in business in quite that way. For example, after giving an important presentation to several hundred people, he might catch me and say, what do you think? Did I do okay? Did it make sense? People are all icebergs. Everyone has a line of visibility. What happens when we reach out to people in agape love? We build relationships. And what happens when we build relationships? We create safety and trust. And we reveal more of one another, ourselves to one another. We lower that line of visibility. Or put another way, agape raises icebergs. Agape reaches out and it raises up. Can I challenge you to think of someone you know, but if you're honest with yourself, you don't really know them. Perhaps you've assumed things about them. Perhaps you've made judgments about them. Perhaps it's a relationship that needs to change. The initiative is with you. Determine that this week, today, you will start the process of reaching out and raising them up. What about work? In your studies, or fulfilling your responsibilities to family and community. Paul writes to the Colossians, whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as though working for the Lord and not for human masters. We are salt in the workplace, in the home, and in our communities. And why? Because our attitude towards work, our commitment to doing the right thing, is not dependent on whether we like the boss or whether we like the work. Our work becomes an expression of God in us and God through us working out agape. What does that look like for you? And it's not always easy. I have somebody at work who I regard as my thorn in my side. Maureen's smiling. She knows exactly who I mean. I don't know why he doesn't like me, but he doesn't like me. And I know that he said some pretty unpleasant things behind my back. I don't know what the problem is. I don't know what I've done. I know that it started about 7 or 8 years ago. I've tried to approach him. I've tried to win him over. But he just seems to be content in his bitterness. And I've come to the conclusion this guy, for the moment anyway, is marching to the beat of a different drummer. But he's successful at what he does. He gets things done. And the good thing is I've learned that I'm not alone. There are others against whom he's taken a similar dislike. And that's very difficult. So how do I react in agape to him at work? I have to work with him. What does agape do in that situation? What would Jesus do? Agape is also the reason why Christians have so often been at the forefront of the fight for social justice. Micah chapter 6, I just love this. He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. How does agape shape our response to what we see in the news, to what we see on our streets? Certainly not apathy. Certainly not walking by on the other side of the street. If the parable of the Good Samaritan was about anything, it was about the meaning of agape, a love that reaches out to lift up. Being lights set on a hill doesn't mean sitting there twinkling brightly. Sometimes we have to blaze. Let me give the final word to Niels Frey again, that theologian. There are many who charge that Jesus never went beyond the previous teachings. They cannot know what they are saying, for either they have never had their eyes opened to agape as the central truth of the New Testament, or else they have fought shy of such a frightening love. When their eyes are once opened, they can exult with Emil Brunner that the whole Bible is only a commentary on that one word, agape. Thank you.